Let's see, it's a, what they call the new word, a bomb? Poly Cafe is a bomb, it's, but it's oh, a
okay. Okay, nice. Starting.
Even if
it's you know, really fun group. Oh, it's Friday afternoon music to sit there and write letters.
Okay, go ahead.
And to listen to music.
We don't have a quorum yet anyway, but yes, okay. We'll see you later.
Yeah.
It's just, and for you, mm-hmm. That music might not, but my grandpa used to sing it all the
this
time.
Meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We are one shy of a quorum. They have checked in, but we'll begin with the presentation of Senate File 2256. Senator Herr. Welcome to the other end of the table.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair and committee. It's an honor to be in front of a community member once again, and this time carrying a bill about one of our state assets, the gray wolf. And this bill, 2256, enact a temporary suspension on wolf hunt in order to collect data to support the wolf management plan and to study outcomes of hunt on wolves and the wolf population in Minnesota. This bill asks for an annual wolf census, educational strategy, and material to reduce conflict between wolves and humans, and set up advisory task force as specified on the line 1.19 to 2.3. Temporary hold continues until we have comprehensive accessible data, as mentioned on section 4B, study of public sentiment toward wolves, and development of best management practices for livestock producer to reduce wolf depredation as described in Section 4D and generate a map showing areas of wolves and human conflicts. Other provisions also include baiting limitation, tribal land restriction, and Zone B training. I also have a number of people here to testify in support of this bill, and also have Mr. Cap Oro to answer any question that require more details. And fellow senator and community members, I want to ask for your support of this bill, Senate File 2256.
Thank you, Senator Herr. And I believe that we've notified both sides that we want to limit testimony on each side to, I believe it was 15 minutes. So if we can have witnesses come up in whatever order you have them in the list on the agenda, in the order you'd like them to come up. If so, Timothy Kaminsky, and then Sandy Skinaway, and Dr. Maureen Hackett would be the first three. Welcome to the committee, and then please identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chairman Marty. My name is Timothy Kaminsky. I'm a practicing wildlife and field biologist. My professional career spans 3 decades, and during that time, began my career here in Minnesota. I was here in 1978, working for Dr. David Meach, again in 1990, and in between as a representative of the Northern Rocky Mountain Wolf Recovery Team, where we were investigating wolf livestock interactions as a precursor for restoring wolves to Yellowstone National Park. During the last 15 years, following my stint that I had in Idaho as the Wolf Project Leader, I became concerned that our management was not sufficiently or very effectively addressing wolf-livestock conflicts. And that was an issue for, I think, working ranchers as well as for the public. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 2256, I founded a group called the Mountain Livestock Cooperative in 2001, and whose basic focus is to conserve working ranches and large carnivores in the Mountain West. I come today with a context for comments just on the bill and in support of it from my experience working for about 40 working ranchers in southern Alberta over the last 2 years in leading a project that actually was designed by working ranchers. And I bring with it 15 years of experience in wolf-livestock interactions that allowed me to be identified as a project leader for that effort. One of the things I want to point to is that back in 1992, in this publication, Trends in Management of Livestock Wolf-Livestock Conflicts in Minnesota, a lot of the effort that we focused on in Alberta addresses two issues brought forward in that report. The first was that where lethal control was operated, that it was clear that social disruption in the wolf packs, that is, their social organization, was disrupted. I'm quoting here on page 20 from the document's primary author, Stephen Fritz. It is obvious that disruption of social organization within the pack occurs under our trapping effort. The other issue that brought the attention of ranchers in southern Alberta was Fritz, Meach, and Bill Paul's near conclusions that in addition to lethal removal of offending animals at farms where there were depredations, that new approaches were needed. They noted that no single technique presently known could resolve depredation problems, but that resolution ought to be sought through a combination of approaches that includes improvements in farm management practices, lethal trapping, and creative non-lethal techniques. We've practiced non-lethal techniques for the last 2 years in southern Alberta in an effective manner. We reduced livestock depredations in that region, both by wolves and grizzly bears. The techniques we used were fit to specific ranch areas. I wouldn't characterize any one particular situation as the same. Many ranchers do things differently, and those changes or differences are important to address. But they can be met in a proactive and a preventive way that serves the economic interests of working ranchers and provides a socially acceptable benefit to people who are interested in seeing wolves on public lands. I'll just comment that wolf-livestock interactions can lead to conflict and economic costs to working ranchers. Some of those involve wounding and loss, but there are other costs, and those involve hardships associated with interactions involving fencing, missing cattle, incomplete use of available pasture or grazing areas, and often weight loss or what we refer to as shrink. And those issues are rarely considered in terms of compensation. So when I reviewed the bill today, I found that many of the issues that we had built our program on in southern Alberta were given rise in Minnesota first. I was also surprised to find that the recommendations offered almost two decades ago are in this bill but haven't really been met. So to practice these efforts and some of the benefits for working ranchers, while important in other places, I guess I would say that I was a little surprised that it had not taken place already here. I'll close my comments this morning, by saying that the project in Alberta was designed to contribute to a science-based and community-driven management prototype. And the goal was to reduce wolf livestock and wolf cattle conflicts on working ranches. By doing so, we were able to provide cost-effective economic benefits to working ranchers and to the public. Fewer bears, grizzly bears, and wolves were required to be removed in those environments. It's a little counterintuitive, but I will say to you that while many people focus on removal of individuals, either through trapping efforts, indiscriminate trapping at times or snaring, and hunts, what we found in Alberta is that wolf packs left in what I would characterize as and carefully characterize as a stable environment. That is, ranchers in the southern Alberta see no reason for taking out wolf packs that aren't causing problems. And in addition, ranchers in Alberta don't see any benefits in trying to keep track of 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 marauding individuals as opposed to a pack that lives in a social organization and works and hunts and lives together. So part of the takeaway from our efforts is that in areas where we have family groups of gray wolves, and in our case in the West, grizzly bears, those animals that take care of their young are wary of humans and are not, as a consequence, offending animals. There's little merit in removing them or disrupting them socially, as identified in Fritz's report. That came as a surprise to a lot of ranchers, but it's their words, not mine, that when hunting season arrives and individuals want access to public land through their private ranches, and they want to know if, that is the hunters, they want to know if they should shoot a wolf or two or three or bears, the comments from the ranchers tend to vary depending on whether or not they're having trouble. And if they are not, they are quick to say, I don't want any wolves or bears shot. I want the gates closed. I want to know how you did, and you'll be welcome back in successive years. I would hope that as you consider some of the attributes of the bill, that one that comes to mind in particular is the use of data. And by use of data, I don't mean collection of data. I'm talking about a conveyance of that information in ways that help ranchers understand how their livestock management and husbandry practices can predispose those animals to risk. And with that understanding, how carnivore behavior and biology can be merged with that in a proactive and preventive way, such that conflicts are reduced. So data held in academic forums, data that shows up in the scientific literature and is never available to working ranchers or farmers, or is so incoherent in scientific jargon that they couldn't understand it if they wanted to, begins to be a problem. And so I would focus not on the amount of data that you gather, but on the quality of it, and how that information can be used to offer a better way forward, not only for the benefit of working ranchers and farmers and their livestock and a sustainable agricultural economy, but also for people in the general public. I don't have any further questions. I'm capable of answering any questions that you might have. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you today, and my thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Kaminsky. We have only about four and a half minutes left for the proponents. I'll interrupt if there are any questions. Are there questions from the committee? If not, Dr. Hackett, please go ahead.
I'll be brief because I think Sandy Skinaway needs to say one or two phrases, so you may want to come up, Sandy, and trade places.
with me as soon as I'm done. Basically, Senate File 2256 is what I consider a compromise from the five-year wait with benefits moving forward, and that is to get publicly accessible data of all known wolf deaths and all known wolf illnesses, including poaching, including car collisions, and those killed when you have a snare for some other animal but you kill a wolf, and other incidental outcomes. It's a public document. Basically, the Senate File 2256 asked for the full implementation of the DNR's own wolf management plan that was developed in the late 90s and has not been implemented. It calls for the establishment of and implementation of best management practices, mapping out wolf-human conflicts so that livestock producers understand where the wolves are. I do know that I've had producers tell me that had they been told that there was a pack nearby, they would have taken other precautions and avoided problems, just like Mr. Kaminsky is talking about. It does ask for a suspension of the hunt, because if you think about it, what Mr. Kaminsky just said is when you disrupt the pack, you now have chaos, and now you have individual wolves sometimes traveling hundreds of miles without a pack looking for easy food. So now you really can't implement proper preventative methods when you've disrupted so much of the environment. We know that the public opposes a wolf hunt. We know from our Lake Research Partner polls that the majority of Minnesotans oppose a wolf hunt. We also know that they really oppose the indiscriminate methods, and that the vast majority agree that a wolf hunt is not necessary if you have other ways of managing wolves. We also know that the DNR's own survey showed 79% opposed a wolf hunt. So this is a compromise asking for a suspension of the hunt. Let's take a step back. We ran for the hunt without even a baseline survey of the wolf population. We've killed 1,086 or 1,088 wolves, depending on how you count them, in 18 months. We have a lot of chaos that was created. We need to find out what's going on, what happens after you do such a massive kill-off of wolves. And we know that not only is there no scientific data showing that lethal control of wolves works for livestock producers, but there's absolutely no data showing that a recreational hunt helps livestock producers. And so, you know, maybe we have a very small minority of hunters that want to kill wolves, but the majority of Minnesotans don't.
Thank you, Dr. Hackett. Sandy Skinaway. We only have about a minute and a half left, so please. Okay.
Thank you. I'm speaking on behalf of the Anishinaabe people of the Sandy Lake Band and Mississippi Ojibwe here in Minnesota. Our purpose here today is to speak for and defend Mayingen, the wolf. I'd like to start off with the story of how the wolf came to be a brother to the Anishinaabe people, but apparently we don't have enough time for that. But I do want to note that the perception of the wolf continues to exist today in our tribal heritage. We believe that our lives are parallel to one another, a shared destiny, as the wolf and the Ojibwe people have suffered the same fates. History has proven that both Mayingen and the Ojibwe have lost our lands. We have both been persecuted and pushed close to destruction and hunted for our hair. Today, however, Mayingen is still being prosecuted and massacred once again by the state-sanctioned hunts, due to misinformation and just plain hatred. The Ojibwe people see the wolf as sentient beings and a relative, and they have a purpose in our shared environment. Others see the wolf as a vicious predator and vermin. As my elder, Robert DeJarlie, had said a couple weeks ago, we have a responsibility to take care of the other three orders of life, which are the earth, the plant world, and the animal world. They do not need us to exist, but we need them. These hunts represent the senseless taking of life. In closing, I just want to say that wolves have as much right to exist and inhabit this land as we do. Respect and coexistence is needed. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Skinaway. And with that, the time has expired for the proponents. Are there any questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. We're going to allow also 15 minutes for the proponents, for the opponents of the bill, and I'll just call them in the order they're on the agenda. If you want to come up in a different order, you're welcome to. Gary Lystico, Tom Peterson, Corey Bennett were the first three.
Eva.
Okay, we'll get a handout just picked up from the... We'll get it distributed. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead, whoever wants to start.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name's Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'll be very brief. Our members are very supportive of the current DNR management, which includes a hunting and trapping season for wolves. I travel the wolf district quite extensively since our last hearing last year, and I continue to ask our members and make sure whether they support it or not. If I've been in Carlton, St. Louis, Cass, Morrison, Roseau, in every meeting I'll ask and get feedback from our farmers, and I've never had one say that that the population isn't healthy enough, in their opinion, to support it. So we would oppose this bill on the merits of that includes a suspension of the current season. I also mentioned, Ms. Hackett just mentioned public opinion poll, and I just wanted to share with you your own scientific state senate state fair poll in which you had a wolf hunting question, and I thought it was interesting in there, and you can look at it and read for yourself, but only 13% of the people in that poll were rural, but 42% or more supported a hunting and trapping season as I read it. So we are not as concerned with data collection. We are concerned about how it pays for and how it would be paid for and administered by the DNR. We always think information is important and feel like the DNR is doing a lot of that collection already. We visit with them, you know, quite often about this issue because it is a top issue for us. We are concerned about the loss of livestock with our cattle. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Good to see you, Mr. Peterson. Good friend, appreciate your testimony. I'm not sure if you said the state fair poll was scientific or unscientific.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I was being in jest. I did say scientific, but I was right, so I'll give you that.
As excited as I get about some of those state fair poll results, we consider the context.
But I thought it was interesting since you mentioned it. I wanted to bring it up.
Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. My name is Corey Bennett with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. Like my colleague, Mr. Peterson, I'll keep my comments very, very brief in respect to others behind me and your agenda. As you can imagine, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association does have some concerns with this bill. We want to thank Senator Herr for the opportunity to visit with him and take time out of his busy schedule to visit with us the other day. It was very kind of him, and so we had a very good discussion, and I want to thank him for that. Mr. Chairman, before the session started, MDHA had our annual meeting in Grand Rapids in which we discussed a variety of deer issues, including wolf management and the management of the wolf. And in those discussions, Mr. Chairman, we had, by a unanimous decision, our chapters, all 62 of them in the state across the state of Minnesota, voted in favor of continuing the management of the wolf and to oppose legislation that would seek to delay, suspend, or somehow repeal the current wolf management plan that includes the hunting and trapping of wolves. And so from that discussion, Mr. Chairman, we do oppose this bill today. We see that because it implements a moratorium on the hunting and trapping of wolves, while a new task force is assembled to create new data and to be used to implement a new wolf management plan. We feel that this move moves us actually backwards instead of forwards in this discussion. We already have a wolf management plan in place. In our opinion, that plan is sound and a good plan that's managed by the DNR. And it's approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And according to a expert in research, Dr. Meech, it is a good plan. And so, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll just keep my comments at that. We do oppose this legislation, and I can stand for any questions the committee members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Are there questions from the committee? If not, we have Mr. Loistico, if he's around, Tim Spreck, and Doug Busselman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Doug Busselman. I'm with the Minnesota Farm Bureau.
Minnesota Farm Bureau is opposed to Senate File 2256. Section 4 of the bill calls for suspension of the wolf hunting season, which we oppose. The management activities which link in this bill to the hunting season suspension process can continue as other types of ongoing management actions are proceeding, regardless of the implementation of responsible hunting seasons that we have had. We consider the hunting season managed by the Department of Natural Resources as having been conducted in an extremely conscientious and conservative fashion. There is nothing from a biological wildlife management perspective to require a suspension of hunting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Busselman. Mr. Spreck.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. MOHA represents approximately 400,000 sportsmen in the state of Minnesota through our 70 member groups. I'll also tack on Gary Lestico from the Minnesota Trappers Association called me this morning to let me know that he had another commitment. He couldn't be here today, but the trappers also echo my sentiments today with regard to the wolf hunt. The Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance stands opposed to this bill. We believe that the DNR has done an excellent job in maintaining it and administering it. The conservative quotas that they've set have been adjusted yearly for any additional changes in population that their surveys indicate. The eyes of the world are watching this, folks. The DNR has been very conservative, and they've done an excellent job, and we would like to support the continuation of the hunt moving forward, and all of the additional roadblocks that have been thrown up in this bill are unnecessary because they've done an excellent job, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spector. Questions from the committee? If not, the DNR, I'm not sure who it was that wanted to. No, he's not here. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer with the Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Dan Stark, our large game carnivore specialist, and I am conscious of your time, so I'm going to be very brief. The DNR does oppose House Senate File 2256. We feel that all of the things in the bill are being covered at this point in time. And just three key points, and I'll let Mr. Stark speak. Tribal entities already have the authority to close their lands to wolf hunting and trapping. Actually, in our hunting handbook, what we have is, and I can provide you with the excerpt, it says, tribal lands of the Red Lake Chippewa Band, lands belonging to Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians in Beltrami, Kuchiching, Lake of the Woods, and Roselle counties are closed to hunting and trapping of wolves than other tribal lands. For specific information on hunting and trapping of wolves on tribally owned lands, consult a local tribal authority. It does not deal with lands within the reservation boundaries, however. It deals with privately owned lands by the tribes that are within the reservation boundaries. The prohibition on the baiting of wolves within 10 miles of tribal lands where taking wolves is prohibited through a GIS exercise that we've completed would impact more than 10 million acres of land. Approximately 9.6 million acres of that land are in non-tribal ownership, which means they're either owned privately or publicly. And also, there is a fiscal note, I believe, that has been submitted by the department on this bill. We're estimating the cost of this bill, which included the establishment of a database, doing all of the work that is there, runs in excess of $1.8 million, and there would also be a decrease in revenues to the Game and Fish Fund of $223,000, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'll turn it over to Dan Stark to provide just a little brief background of our hunting and management of the wolf.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stark.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Stark. The DNR's wolf management goal is to assure the long-term survival of the wolf while addressing conflicts with wolves and humans. Minnesota wolf hunting season was developed based on data and research from state and national wolf experts. Minnesota has more data on the wolf population than for most other managed species in the state, and it is one of the most highly studied animals in the state of Minnesota. By design, the DNR has established a conservative hunting and trapping season. The first two seasons were not intended to lower the wolf population or address depredation and human conflicts. The hunting and trapping season, as developed by the DNR, poses no long-term threat to the wolf population. Target harvests have been conservative numbers and more than adequate to assure that we continue to have a thriving wolf population here in the state. DNR plans to update the wolf management plan beginning this year and expects the process to take approximately 1 year. And we'll also incorporate stakeholder and public input on the planning process.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Scalzi, then Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stark, I was in the House prior to coming to the Senate, and I'm just kind of curious, when you talk about a wolf management plan, had there not been a big political push for a wolf hunting and trapping season, was the DNR proposing a wolf management plan on their own, or was this in response and in accordance with the political pressure to create this season?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, were you asking, was there pressure to create the season or a management plan?
No, very specifically, I know there was a lot of political pressure to create a hunting and trapping season because I was there, and I know the people that were proposing it. Had the DNR prior to that great pressure been working on a wolf management plan that would have included hunt and trap?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, the initial wolf plan that is in place was adopted in 2001, and that includes population management, but limited a wolf season for 5 years following the time that they were removed from the endangered species list. In 2011, the wolf was classified as a small game species, and that five-year period was removed, so that's when the DNR started to develop a season proposal.
Mr. Chairman, just really quickly on that point, the legislature directed us, and we worked on that wolf management plan in 2001 in anticipation of delisting in the early 2000s. The history that I think most of you are familiar with involves a period of two or three delistings, lawsuits at the federal level, which relisted the wolf again. So our wolf management plan has been in place since 2001, and we've been actively looking at updating it and managing the material that's in there throughout that time. And as Mr. Stark said, we're going to continue that process as well.
Senator Rosen and Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stark, on the wolf management plan also, I do have a question. You mentioned a continuation of that. Actually, it mentions it in the bill in 2.16 to implement the wolf management plan. Your stakeholder group, who are you planning on having involved in the stakeholder group?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, we haven't developed a group or planned who's going to be involved in the – we're in the very initial stages of reviewing and assessing the wolf plan and how we might update it.
So, Mr. Chair –
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Stark, the study that they're talking about in the bill, I think really to me a study and a wolf management plan could be viewed as being the same. The difference is they're asking for in the bill a suspension of the hunt until the study is done. Is that correct? And I would hope that the stakeholders who have developed this this bill — obviously, it's like a 50-50 split when you start looking at some of the opinion poll here — that hopefully people in this room will be involved in that stakeholders group. And my question to you is, when will you implement the plan when it is complete?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the current wolf plan is in place that is being implemented. So any updates to that or changes to that, when that's completed, we would implement them. So it could be following the process, which would take up to about a year.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stark, let's go back to the stakeholders then. In the past, who have been the stakeholders developing this wolf management plan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, initially the wolf planning process was initiated back in 1998. And that involved a group of 33 different stakeholders, which included conservation groups, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, the Minnesota Trappers Association, livestock interests, wolf advocacy organizations, animal rights groups, so it was a broad spectrum of people that had an interest in wolf management.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stark, so, and you have been continually working on this management plan since 1998, you said? 2001, there was another plan. Has all the interested groups been at the table? That's what I'm trying to get at. And will they continue to be at the table to develop a wolf management plan, which I think is very important?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the current wolf plan has a section in there that talks about reviewing the plan and assessing the plan, and that doesn't include involving a broad spectrum of stakeholders. So I think this would be different than what the original plan had intended. That included agency personnel that are involved in wolves and natural resource management. Any stakeholder group that would be used to revise or update the plan should represent, you know, a broad interest in wolf management, similar to what it had done initially.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Stark, so do you need to be asked to be on this? I mean, can the tribes, can some of the advocacy groups, can they plan on being asked to develop this wolf management plan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, I don't know that I can answer that right now. I don't know what the formal process would be for initiating the stakeholder group. We haven't gotten to that point in our planning for the update of the plan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, we're in communication with the tribal governments in accordance with the governor's executive order on tribal consultation on an almost continual basis, particularly in the northern parts of the state, dealing with deer hunting, and wolf populations, walleye, fisheries, invasive species. So they will be a part of this, and we will do our best to make sure that other stakeholders are involved and can actively participate as we update the wolf management plan. It's not the intention to exclude any particular party, but trying to make sure that we come up with a management plan that moves everybody's objectives forward.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate that, Assistant Commissioner. I really do, because it seems when you've been here and so these issues keep reoccurring, keep coming to the table, and prenatal screening, Mr. Chair. How many times have we seen that, Senator Benson? These issues keep coming to the legislature, and I think you cannot move forward in a positive way without all the stakeholders at the table. And that's what I'm trying to stress. Everybody should have a voice in this very passionate issue, obviously. And the room is full. We have two different opinions, and I do think there is a chance to come to some kind of agreement here. And it's going to come out of this wolf management plan or the best management practices with the Commissioner of Natural Resources and Agriculture, or whatever way we want to do this. You have to have all the stakeholders at the table.
Thank you, Senator Rosen, Senator Dibble, then Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just following up on Senator Scalzi's question. Mr. Stark, you said that in 2011, the wolf was delisted or classified as a small game species, and then the 5-year waiting period was removed. By whom was it removed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, that was a change in legislation.
It was removed by the legislature. And Mr. Stark, did the DNR support that change, the elimination of the 5-year waiting period?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, at the time, the DNR was not opposed to it.
Thank you. I think that answers Senator Scalzi's question.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is either for Senator Herr or a committee member. But Senator Herr, I have a question specifically in Section 4 and on line 2.25. I'm interested in what is meant by the last part of that sentence where it says, including issues related to intolerance. Can you give me some definition on that?
Yes, may I call Ms. Skinaway to clarify that? My understanding is that to have some respect toward wolves and
tolerate toll roads. But let me ask Ms. Skinaway to give that in more accurate detail.
Yes, she's
okay. Ms. Dr. Hackett?
I had questions.
Yes, the issue of intolerance is the whole reason that we're sitting here. The wolf was literally wiped out throughout the United States, and we were down to a few wolves in Minnesota when it was placed on the endangered species list. And essentially, since that time, we've had livestock producers and hunters wanting to kill wolves again all the time. And we have the public being confused when we held the hunt, thinking, well, we must have too many wolves if we're having a recreational hunt. So the issue of intolerance is the prejudice, the knowledge, the attitudes of people towards wolves, and whether they go out of their way to kill them. And that's a very important thing that was placed in the, or an issue in the wolf management plan that has really not been addressed.
Senator Brown.
And Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Hackett. I looked up the definition of intolerance, and it says an unwillingness to accept views, beliefs, or behavior that differ from one's own. It would seem to me, Senator Herr, that there is intolerance on both sides of this issue. So I'm wondering, it sounds from Dr. Hackett's testimony, that we only want to look at intolerance from one side of the issue. I'm wondering if that's defined in this bill. It seems to me that if the commissioner is going to do a study, we should look at intolerance from both sides of the issue.
My understanding thing is that we're talking about wolves, so wolves are different from human. Human had the ability to hate, whereas wolf doesn't have that ability.
No, I'm not, Mr. Chair, Senator Herr, I'm not talking about wolves' intolerance. I'm talking about this issue. There's two sides to every issue. Mm-hmm. This one, there are those who support this legislation. There are those who oppose this legislation. And I'm just saying if we're going to throw in the word intolerance in the legislation, then we should look at the intolerance of those who support this and those who oppose it and not just be one-sided.
In that case, I'd like to hear, you know, the opposing side of and what their point of view on intolerance, you know, because the bill itself is talking about gathering information, and you know, we have time to, you know, pause and investigate and collect data first before we went on to what you inquire for information.
Mr. Chair and Senator Herr, I guess my point is, and it goes to somewhat what Senator Rosen had said, we tend to look at this from one side, whether we favor it or we don't favor it. But if we're going to incorporate this into the bill, and it is in the bill, if the commissioner is going to do a study, let's get a well-rounded study and look at intolerance on both sides of the issue. And I'm not sure that's what the intent of this bill is.
And I believe that's why there's a number of stakeholders that will be at the table, which is also add a number additional stakeholder as well. And having a number of people at the table will be deciding further after we pass this bill.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I suppose, is for either Mr. Meyer or Mr. Stark. How is it determined that something is a large game species or a small game species? I thought it was pretty unusual to redesignate the wolf to a small game species when it occurred, and I've been wondering how that determination was made.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Eaton, those terms are defined, I mean, in statute, a small game species and big game species. I think Mr. Stark may be able to provide a little bit of insight on that, but the classification related to small game had to deal with more of the management and the seasons than the actual taxonomic or ecological classification of the animal. So I can, I think Mr. Knopf is providing some gathering the statutory references, but I don't know if Mr. Stark has anything to add or not.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, you can keep going ahead.
Thank you. I guess I'm not clear, Mr. Meyer. What I want to know is why the wolf was redesignated as a small game species, was that to so that you're able to hunt them, or was it? I'm trying to find the motivation between why it was changed to a small game species.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, go ahead.
Mr. Knopf has comments.
Mr. Chair, before the department comments, one of the reasons that it's classified as a small game is all of our fur bearers are classified as small game. And so the wolf being a fur bearer was classified as small game to be consistent with all the other things that are trapped in the state, the fur bearers that are trapped.
Thank you.
In other words, it's all a matter of perspective. It's a big, small game.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, the other aspect of that, if it wasn't listed as on the in the definition of small game, it wouldn't be protected under state law with restrictions on the season. That's one way that we are allowed to limit the protections or limit the take of wolves at certain times of the year based on that statute.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stark, so you're saying that there are no game limits for large game species? There's no limits and take?
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, no, that's not what I'm saying. I thought you were asking why it was listed as small game or on the small. Prior to that, it wasn't listed as either.
Oh. Thank you.
So, Mr.
Senator Scalzi. Just to further ask related to Senator Eaton's question, what is your title again? Would you tell us again what your title is, Mr. Stark?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, I'm the large carnivore specialist for the DNR.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, what's the next destination for this bill, assuming it passes?
What's the destination?
What's the next destination?
I was just asking about it. It's apparently state and local would see it next, and then would go to finance.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would motion to move the bill 2256.
Senator Osmond moves Senate file 2256 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Governments.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Senator Brown requests a roll call. Is there further discussion? If not, on the... You have the roll call. Okay.
Any more discussion?
Yeah. Is there more discussion on the motion? If not, we'll take the roll.
Senator Marty.
Aye.
Senator Scalzi.
Aye.
Senator Eaton.
Aye.
Senator Dibble. Senator Seaman. Senator Rosen.
No.
Senator Brown.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
Aye.
Wake up.
Senator Coonan.
No.
Senator Herr.
Aye.
Senator Benson.
No.
Senator Schmidt. Senator Weber.
No.
Senator Osmick.
No.
Mr. Chair, could we hold the vote open until the people across the hall could get here?
Have they been... Okay. They've asked to vote. Okay. Are they coming in?
Yeah, they just started.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll hold for just a minute for that because they did express interest. And Senator Dibble is here now. Senator Dibble, there's a motion to refer to pass the bill, send it to state and local committee. You're voting a roll call here.
Oh, yes.
Is there anybody else who is over there? Senator Seaman or Senator Schmidt?
Seaman's downstairs.
Mr. Chair, did Senator Seaman check in?
I do not know. Did she check in?
She is not.
And
so?
And they're not, then we should. We have to close the vote then, yes, if they have not checked in and expressed interest. And
how about you, Ms.? he didn't check in.
Marty skills Eaton.
Yeah, I got 6-6.
Yeah. Steven.
Yeah, 6-6. On a vote of 6-6, the motion does not prevail. Thank you very much. Next bill, Senator Sieben is not here yet. I don't know where she is, but we hope is here soon. So we will take up my bill next.
I'm pissed.
That's okay. Why he called for the vote.
Sure. We didn't have the vote.
Okay. So, Lyle?
Chair? Is there a doing the cut? There's no reason why those people don't care.
Yeah. If you want the bill to pass, you better have it. What a shame.
Who's going to be with me?
Yeah.
That was a total failure on the part of
people to
They are leaving the flag. Mr. Chair, we have Senate File 2191, which is the our omnibus policy bill, I guess it's called. And I have Mr. Meyer to go through the bill, and I believe we have at least one amendment that I'd like to put on the bill to put the bill in shape. This is the first committee for it. All the amendments being distributed, maybe Mr. Meyer can start going through the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, and I want to thank Senator Marty for carrying our legislation today. This is the DNR policy technical bill. It also contains several sections that are related to unsession as well that are more technical in nature that we contained in this bill. And you should have a fact sheet within your packet that describes the bill as well. As the amendment is passed out, I will describe the sections that are impacted by the amendment. The amendment before you, Senator Marty's author's amendment, deletes section 1 of the bill. So I will go to sections 2. And there are several sections listed here that deal with this concept. And what we're talking about is changing the process that we use for designating infested waters from designated, which required a notification in the state register and a bunch of other processes that it seems like we're doing on a continual basis these days. What we'd like to do is list the lakes rather than designate them. And I will get to the process that we're proposing to use as we get to that section in the bill. So with that, Chair, members, Section 3 of the bill deals with a ban or a prohibition that was placed on the DNR, actually by the Division of Parks in the day, that put a limit of $25,000 on the total value of promotional items given to the department. This has presented a lot of confusion and unnecessary kind of housekeeping within the department. The example I raise is what if someone were to donate a manufacturer, Berkeley, for example, down in Iowa, would donate a large amount of fishing poles, Snoopy poles, rods and reels for us to use on Take a Kid Fishing Day. Do we then need to track the value of that gift, those poles, as part of this package? We aren't going to increase our spending in any way, shape, or form under this provision, but just remove unnecessary procedures within the department. Section 4, again, deals with that change in designation to listing. Section 5 deals with that section as well. Section 6 is a section relating to the permitting efficiency goals. I believe this is in, also in Senator Scalzi's bill she's carrying dealing with permitting. It removes the provision for a biannual or a six-month report within the bill. Section 7 clarifies that we can track, clarify the DNR authority to bill and carry forward revenue available to cover costs of both maintaining and operating facilities. Section 8 is changing a reference from the previous year that was changed. We missed a section in statute changing ATV training requirements from 16 to 18. Section 9, there is language within Section 9 within your amendment that just clarifies the intention of this. As the bill was codified or drafted in the revisor's office, the meaning of our language was changed around. The intent of this language, which is in the author's amendment, is to allow your Buick four-door car to be able to be used on forest roads that are also designated as off-road trails during the hunting season without having to buy an off-road sticker. Sections 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, all deal with that changing the designated to listed. And actually, if you go to, I'm going to find the section that describes how we're going to do that here. Get to that in a second as we move forward here. Section 20 deals with the designated to listing again. 21 does the same thing. Section 22 provides for a streamlined process that we'll be using for implementing our master plans and also creates an amendment process that you'll see beginning on 14.25. Right now, we do not have a process to amend our master plans for any unit of the Outdoor Recreation Act. So you'll see that there. Section 23 just clarifies that the Historical Society and the Department of Natural Resources shall each compile a list of units of the Outdoor Recreation Act. The Historical Society does support that. Section 24 will be removing under the author's amendment. Section 25 is another change with designated and list. Section 26 deals with floodplain management ordinances. This is a clarification that we're looking at to amend the language to remove the requirement that we have to notify local units of government that technical information on delineation of floodplains is available. Basically, the floodplain management that's in place in the state now has come to the place in time where everybody has floodplain management ordinances that needs them, and we're working closely with those units of government to make sure they understand those issues. Section 22, or 27, I should say, deals with that clarification of floodplain management plan. Section 28 is just clarifying that FEMA and the flood hazard areas are identified and that local units of government are encouraged to apply for participation in the flood insurance program. Section 29 is a clarification of removing debris, including logs that are on near the surface. This is already covered in rule, so this is kind of removing some unneeded statutes in law, or words in law. Section 30 allows for lake-wide or bay-wide treatments of aquatic invasive species that we already are doing, and for the most part, this just clarifies that we can do that. Section 31 will allow for the Department of Natural Resources to create a master plan for the Minnesota River Valley area that will look at not only the recreation or the conservation aspects, but the cultural resources of the area and provide us with guidance on what. There's some stakeholders in the area that would like us to create a new unit of the Outdoor Recreation Act that would allow for not only hunting and fishing, but also outdoor recreation such as horseback riding. Those questions will be dealt with within the master plan, which will address the natural and cultural resources, interpretive services, recreational opportunities, and administrative activities in the area, and also provide a recommendation on the designation of what that unit should be called. The concept we have is the Minnesota River Valley Conservation and Recreation Area. Actually, Senator Coonan, this would be in your district. I believe you participated in those discussions. It would basically run from Upper Lower Sioux to Fort Ridgely State Park. And the vision that some people have down there is a series of bed and breakfasts or something that a person could ride their horses through state-owned, publicly-owned lands overnight and continue on, much like we do snowmobiling in the wintertime. Section 33 is just a reviser's note codifying those changes from designate to listed. And Section 34 is the repealer, which you can see on the back of the bill. We're repealing several sections of laws that are reference to flood management ordinances 103F, 121, and 165. We're also repealing a Forest Road Coordination Committee that's in statute. We rarely hold these formal type meetings, but we work at the local level with constituents on forest roads, on the issues of management, wherever needed. And you'll also see that 84.521 is an antiquated repealer dating back to 1949.
So, and Mr. Chair, on the A1 amendment, I'd like to incorporate this one. Apparently missed it, but we'd be deleting sections 1 and 24, and then, as you see on the A1 amendment, deleting section 9 and inserting a new section 9. And I'd like to move that to put the bill in the shape that it was just presented.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Marty moves his author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I didn't hear all the motion.
Are you also delete sections about 1, 24, and 9 replaced with the new language.
So that would be part of the
I want that to
amendment.
Be all incorporated
yes. Okay.
into this
Just
amendment.
Just to make sure I get it clear. Thanks.
Yeah. I'm sorry that the first one we were going to do orally, and then we came up with this other one, so I guess, anyway.
Okay.
So I'd move that.
Members, did everybody understand that? Okay, all in favor of the A1 amendment as amended, I guess, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The amendment as amendment is adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, happy to stand for questions. I don't know of anybody who would be here in opposition to it or whatever, but you might ask. See if.
Okay. Before we do that, Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I just had two brief questions. Now I've lost my page. The ATV training is being raised from 16 to 18. I'd like to understand what was the thinking behind that, or is there something else going on somewhere in statute that moves this to 18?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, yes, actually this is a technical correction to correct changes made last session that raised the training date from 16 to 18. We may be changing it. That was carried by the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota. I believe they wish to change that back to 16, so we may need an additional amendment to replace this language and undo the changes from last session. I didn't have a chance to figure that piece of it out for this bill, but this is codifying changes that were made last session, to your first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the second question, the removal of debris, you said that was taken care of in rule, and so it didn't need to be in statute, but that was a fairly new addition to statute, so why didn't we know it was in rule then? And I've lost track of the section. Section 29, 17.24.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, we did discuss that when that language was being added at the time. Some people thought that they would rather see the language in statute as well, so we're just trying to clarify. Clean up some statutes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Meyer? Okay. Anybody else who would like to testify on Senate File 2191? Senator Marty?
I think the bill goes to the floor next. After we took out that one section, we've gone elsewhere. With that, I'll move that Senate File 2191 as amended be recommended pass.
Okay, any further discussion? All in favor of Senator Marty's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The amendment, or the motion carries.
Thank you, and perhaps we'll take Senator Sieben's bill next since she's here. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move for reconsideration of 2256.
That's the first one. If so, I want to make sure all members of the committee are notified about that. If you want to pursue that, and then we consider that after this next bill so that people have a chance to be notified, because I want to make sure all members of the committee are aware of that.
Mr. Chair, for my clarification, I've never had the experience of a bill failing to pass on a tie. I understand to make a motion to reconsider, you have to be on the prevailing side. Could you please review for me what happens on a tie?
I understand from committees. I don't know that you have to be on prevailing side. Do somebody... Could you guys check?
Not on committee, Mr. Chair.
Not on committee?
On the floor.
I know on the floor you have to be on the prevailing side, because she was not on the prevailing side of that vote. I believe in committee you don't need to. And is there Senate rules that speak to that? Does anybody know?
Mr. Chairman, it's been a while since I've looked at that section in Mason's, but it's my understanding that some of those rules are relaxed in committee in Mason's. Now, some committees have a tradition of not allowing somebody who is not on the prevailing side to make that motion, but I think it's really kind of up to the committee and up to more of the general practice of the committees of the Senate. On the floor, it's a rule that's a binding rule. But again, Mason's in committee does talk about relaxing some of those requirements.
And that was my understanding of what we've done in the past.
Chair,
Senator Eaton.
My purpose is that Senator Sieben wished to have an opportunity to vote on the bill.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I can't say that I'm opposed to that, but I would like every member of this committee to be present. Whether they were here on the first vote or not, I would like every member of this committee to be present before we take that vote.
And, Mr. Chair, I specifically asked if Senator Sieben had checked in, because it had been mentioned that she might want the opportunity to vote, and she had not checked in. And so
that's why we closed the vote.
Mr.
Yes.
Chair, and just so that I can be clear, put it on the record, I was presenting a bill in the education policy at the time and didn't know that the vote was coming at the time. So I appreciate you trying to get me here, Senator Benson.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I had actually asked committee assistant when we were looking for quorum if he could go get Senator Sieben so she could check in. So the irony of me then having to see, but if we're going to make accommodation for people who weren't checked in, then everyone who's on the committee, should they be at the Capitol today, should check in and be present for that vote. And I would support Senator Brown in that.
And I will suggest, ask committee staff, and maybe we have to get the page to go around and do that and notify members that we are going to have a motion for that. I will ask you to set aside your motion until after the next bill, so the pages do have the ability to contact you. So, I'm going to consider everybody in the room right now notified of her intent to do that. But there are several others who are across the hall. There's Senator Schmidt, just check. We wanted to let you know there's been a request to reconsider the vote on Senate File 2256, Wolf Management Bill. You and Senator Sieben were not in the room at the time, and we want to make sure. So either if you're going to be here or if not, we want you to know after Senator Sieben's bill, we're going to have a motion that Senator Eaton plans to pursue. So anyway, if Senator Eaton, if you're willing to postpone that until after this bill, I would appreciate that, so we have the time to notify people.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
With that, Senator Sieben, welcome to the committee, Senate File 2272.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2272 is a bill related only to the lower St. Croix Wild and Scenic Riverway. By way of what I'll do is give a brief background in the situation, go over in broad strokes the two sections of the bill, and then allow the testifiers to further explain some of the rationale for behind bringing this bill forward. So, as members may know, the DNR exercised certification or veto authority on variances from 1972, when the Lower St. Croix Riverway rules were promulgated, until 2010, when there was a Supreme Court case decision that found that the authority was not grounded in statute. So over the 30-year time span, the DNR, I've been told, certified over 90% of the local variances on the Lower St. Croix and received fewer than 10 requests for contested case hearings. During that time, the burden was and continues to be on local governments to arrive at the right decisions on variances consistent with their ordinances. So the DNR worked in partnership with local governments by attending hearings, providing input on whether proposals met ordinance requirements or impacted river resources, and suggest modifications more consistent with the intent of the ordinance. It was under rare occasions that a local government and or the DNR did not succeed or would not succeed in getting a project modified so it could be approved. The DNR never used variance certification as a threat or a hammer, I've been told. Rather, it wanted local governments to own their own decisions. So the DNR didn't offer opinions to landowners on whether variances would be certified so as to not subvert the local decision-making process. The Supreme Court decision that I mentioned, the Hubbard variance decision in the city of Lakeland, was one of the few decisions that the DNR did not certify because the city hadn't developed an adequate record to demonstrate the hardship criteria were met for approving the variances. The DNR issued a letter of non-certification of the local decision, and the applicant and city requested a contested case hearing before an administrative law judge who found in favor of the department. That decision was then challenged in the Minnesota Court of Appeals and reversed. The DNR environmental organizations then petitioned the Minnesota Supreme Court for review. And rather than review the whole case, the Minnesota Supreme Court found on the issue of certification or focused on the issue of certification and found the DNR lacked express and implied statutory authority to certify variance decisions by local units of government. So since that decision, the sole responsibility and burden of proof for defending variance decisions now rests with the local units of government. The DNR's only recourse if it disagrees with a local variance decision is to appeal to the district court. Obviously, that's costly for the DNR and local governments and damages relationships between them, the two entities. In 2011, the legislature amended the variance criteria in county and city zoning enabling statutes, changing the hardship test to a less stringent practical difficulties test, therefore making it difficult for local cities to say no to variances. Obviously, deciding on variances is a challenging job for local governments. They must balance the desires of property owners against protecting a public resource. The current variance criteria doesn't give local governments much guidance and can lead to decisions that aren't compatible with the river's National Wild and Scenic designation. So the legislation, Senate File 2272, will help ensure that local units and the DNR will continue to work in partnership. It will also provide additional criteria focused on protecting the outstanding resources and values of the Lower St. Croix, consistent with the Lower St. Croix Act and Cooperative Management Plan. And it will help local governments make legally defensible decisions that protect the river. So now turning to the bill, Section 1 is the review and certification part of the bill. Again, It establishes a review and certification process for the DNR to review and certify local ordinances and variances issued for the Lower St. Croix Wild and Scenic River. This provision has been part of the DNR rules for the Lower St. Croix Wild and Scenic River, but was overturned in the case I mentioned. The court ruled that the DNR didn't have the implied statutory authority for the rule. So that is what this legislation in Section 1 is addressing. Section 2 provides additional criteria to review variances for actions on the Lower St. Croix River. As you can see, it provides general variance criteria for local variances, and then these three conditions that would have to be that would need to be met. It also specifies local authorities approving a variance must require natural resource protection, require the applicant to show why the ordinance can't be accommodated, and provide that the variance must be granted if without it there's no reasonable use of the property. Before I turn it over to my testifiers, I'll just add that I think that this bill, there are different iterations of the legislation that we talked about before arriving at the bill that you see before us. We're trying to, as I said, provide clarity for local units of government while at the same time balancing the unique and special resource we have in the Lower St. Croix. And so with that, I'll turn it over first to Deb Ryan, who's the executive director of the St. Croix River Association.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Ryan.
Thank you, Chairman Marty. Again, my name is Deb Ryan. I'm with the St. Croix River Association. Our association is made up of members that live and work along the St. Croix River. We are speaking here in support of Senate File 2272, a bill to reestablish the Minnesota Certification Authority on variances requested for development. The authority, as has been stated, was assumed until the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled otherwise in 2010. The St. Croix River is one of the cleanest and probably the cleanest tributary to the Mississippi River. It supports a highly diverse flora and fauna. The same 40 species of mussels that were here 300 years ago are still here today. Several of those are rare. It's a fantastic fishery. We have sturgeon, smallmouth bass, muskie, and many more fish that people from around the world come to enjoy. It's highly valued for recreation. In 2008, AAA reported that it's the second highest tourist destination to the Mall of America. The Lower St. Croix recreation, boating, and angling brings in an estimated $25,800,000 annually over the summer. In 1968, the Upper St. Croix and Namekagon Rivers were one of the original eight nationally designated wild and scenic rivers. It is the only one of those eight that is considered a national park. In 1972, the Lower Riverway was designated as well, and the states, the local units of government, took shared responsibility over governance. There is a mix of ownership along the rivers with the national and state lands, and there is land that is privately held. The land in private ownership has an easement to protect the bluff lands and wild and scenic values of the riverway. When a person has a property along the riverway, they own an investment in the national park. New landowners pay a premium price for the views that they enjoy. With that view comes an easement, and with that comes protecting the wild and scenic nature for all people to enjoy. Just as agricultural landowners are forbidden to clear the trees and crop along the river, homeowners are required to follow the same and their rules of their easement. That 1/4 mile wide at tops easement has done so much to protect the St. Croix River. Water quality remains high. There is good habitat for birds and other wildlife. The unique characters remain, and it boosts the economy for the small towns along the river. Landowners benefit, obviously, from increased property value. The state's oversight of local land use decisions helped governments to protect local governments to protect the state nationally significant river corridor. Since the 2010 Supreme Court decision, the sole responsibility and burden of proof for defending variance decisions now rest with the local units of government. As has been stated, approximately 60 known variants have been requested in Minnesota in the last 30 years, with greater than 90% approved. There have been approximately 8 demands for hearings once the DNR rules took effect, and most of those were settled out of court. Variance certification had been in place since the rules were developed. Without this bill, the only recourse decision is to appeal in district court, a costly and adversarial process. Variance requests are increasing. Recently, a landowner asked for and received 5 variances on one property. There are several additional homeowners that are coming forward with requests that are likely to be considered. All we're asking for is to reestablish what has been assumed the state's responsibility since the early 1970s. This bill is very specific to the lower St. Croix and does not affect the rest of the state. Local officials will once again be shielded from pressure to develop without regard to protecting the wild and scenic values of our river. This authorization is necessary to the preservation and administration of the lower St. Croix River as a wild and scenic river.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. Mr. Palmquist?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the opportunity to speak. My name is Bill Palmquist. I live in Afton. For the last 5 years, I've represented Ward 1 on the City Council. There in that ward is from the old village down to Afton State Park. But our city hasn't had a meeting on this, so I'm not here representing the City Council. These are my own views. So, as a local official, I have to say this 2272 is tricky. We like local control, and giving it up is pretty difficult. But that being said, I just want to talk about why I think it's a good idea. The line in the legislation that really sticks out to me is one that says to promote uniformity in the treatment of applications for exceptions. And the reason I would like that protection back in is I worry that once the perception is out in our communities, that certain residents are being held to a higher or a different standard than they are in a neighboring community, that we're going to see more and more pressure, and I think that was mentioned earlier, on our bodies to approve variances if they're being approved right up the street. So I don't want to put our volunteer planning commissions and our part-time city council members in a position where they're going to be asked to deny a variance that was just approved real nearby. I also think that unless we're careful, we can see the watering down, the protections that have created what we have today in the lower St. Croix River, sort of one variance at a time, and I worry that it'll spiral. The only thing I would add in addition to this is, as we work to balance, is to try to find some balance in how we protect the river but also preserve our history. You know, we have a historic river town in Afton that we're working hard and investing a lot of money in to help preserve. We're doing it for two reasons. Number one, we're trying to make sure we're not adding to the problem, the environmental problems that the river's having right now. We're trying to treat stormwater, get septics out of the system, out of the floodplains and that kind of thing. But at the same time, I don't want to – we're doing it to preserve that historic river town. So as we move forward and as the DNR, if this bill passes, takes back over some control over that, I just want to make sure that we in the rulemaking kind of single out those historic districts and we don't unnecessarily or inadvertently hinder the ability to invest in those and reinvest and restore those properties, because they will be subject to this bill. These historic little communities are right next to the river. But in the end, you know, I believe that this bill will hinder, or not hinder, but it's going to help our local governments. As was mentioned, it's a resource of regional significance, and we're fortunate enough to live right near it. And I think creating the continuity in the variance process that this bill will do will alleviate a lot of the inherent pressure that I worry is going to start coming down without that type of control. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Palmquist. Senator Brown, and then we'll have the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Palmquist, I'm going to ask this of you since you're on the City Council and you made reference to this part of the bill. In lines 1.10 and 1.11, it talks about unjustified exceptions. Could you give me some examples of what you as a City Councilman might deem as unjustified exceptions?
Well, you know, to rise to the level of requiring a variance, there's a lot of hoops that you have to jump through. You know, my interpretation of that is really that we're just maybe skipping over some of the requirements that are set forth in the rules that we have as a city, and then also that the Lower St. Croix designation puts upon us.
Senator Brown. Mr. Chair, Senator Seaman, I don't know if you'd agree with that or if you have any additional comments.
No, Mr. Chair, I think that Mr. Palmquist did a good job of explaining what some of the exceptions could be.
All right, thank you.
Thank you both very much. We have Jennifer Shilcox from DNR and Craig Johnson from the League of Cities both wish to speak to the bill as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Jennifer Shilcox is here. She can provide technical and questions. We have been working with Senator Seaman and the Lower St. Croix Association to try to put some more sideboards on this situation. The Supreme Court decision several years ago did make the bar very low for variance approval. And in this section of the river, because it is a federally designated wild and scenic river area, we do support trying to bring back some of those kind of considerations in this process. So if you have technical questions, Ms. Shilcox can answer them, or if you want to go to other testimony, we can come back and address technical questions at that
point.
Are
there questions at this time for Ms. Shilcox? If not, we may have you back if people have questions after Mr. Johnson speaks. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and have been communicating with the proponents of the bill and with the staff of Senator Seaman trying to get ready for this hearing. I can summarize my position, as I think will probably not be a surprise to most people, that the League of Minnesota Cities does not support taking away the local government's ability to make the final decision in land use planning, zoning, and variance decisions. We've worked very, very hard on that issue. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into those aspects of that, because that's really, I'm sure, will be covered at the local government committee level when we get into the details of the procedure. But because it was discussed in earlier comments and testimony, just want to be clear of a couple of things. First of all, cities spend a tremendous amount of time, whether they're in the Lower St. Croix region or anywhere else in the state, dealing with land use planning, zoning, and variances. Every decision they make is a balancing of property rights and public interests between a large number of interested parties. They take it very, very seriously, and there are very strict guidelines for that. And I would remind the committee that those guidelines changed in 2011. There was significant legislation that changed to make consistent the variance requirements for towns, cities, and counties, make them the same for all three. And it does not make it so we can't deny a variance. It actually makes it a three-part test that must be met for a variance to be considered. And then from there, you make the decision on whether the variance is appropriate. The three-part test is that the property has to be essentially denied, it has to be asking for a reason to be used in a reasonable manner and unable to do so because of a local ordinance. The reason that use cannot be, or that manner cannot be, reasonable manner cannot be implemented, has to not be the fault of the property owner. They can't have already done something to the property to make it so that they don't get that use. And it cannot alter the essential character of the neighborhood that the project is happening in. All of these things have extensive background, and the reason that that language was chosen in that very thorough and contentious fight in 2011 was because of the case law that exists that defines what reasonable manner is, what unique is, what essential character of property and neighborhoods is. And we really do have to meet all of those tests. And our decisions always have to be consistent with our other local ordinances and with state and federal law. We can't ever say we're not going to follow state and federal law with a variance. We can only deal with local ordinances. So, members, I can go into the language of this bill more specifically, but I would just say overall, if local governments for some reason are seen as not being able to say no to variances, that's a surprise to most of my cities, I would say. But also, this bill doesn't change anything in regards to that. The criteria we use will remain identical for variances in either case. It's just that in this case, we won't know the answer for what happened with that variance until the DNR decides to come back and tell us whether it's approved or not. I would also add, Mr. Chair and members, that city government must make all of these decisions under Statute 15.99, which is a 60-day rule requirement. We have a very tough threshold of getting through these decision-making processes and making those final decisions. And it does make us have to do the work very, very well and document it very, very well. Final comment, Mr. Chair, is just that right now there is a tool. The DNR does have a tool. They do have the ability, if they feel something has been done in the wrong manner, to go to the district court and ask for relief from that decision. That has been used, and it has been used successfully on shoreland-related issues in Crow Wing County, for example. And most frequently, much like every other thing, the pending court process causes everyone to sit down and work out a better solution. It does not end up being an expensive litigation. In one case it did, DNR prevailed and got the change they needed because of a legal problem with the decision that had been made. So we really think the tools are already there for DNR. Yes, it is contentious if you have to go to district court to make a decision, but it's very, very rare, and it would actually have to mean that the local government made their decision in an illegal manner, not just that DNR didn't like the result of the decision, which we think is a much tougher situation for a local government to be put in. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to respond to you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions from the committee. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I understand where the league is coming from in this situation. I'm kind of wondering, though, most cities, and I would say the great majority of your member cities, are not on a federally designated wild and scenic river or Lake Superior or something that might impact their decisions in a different manner. Wouldn't you agree that the federal designation of this wild and scenic river might make a little bit of difference and might make Senate File 2272 have some teeth instead of going to court?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is a different situation. There are, obviously, we have the North Shore. We have many designated trout streams. We have numerous outstanding resource value waters and other recreational waters that have been designated. We have the entire critical area running through along the Mississippi River all the way through the Twin Cities. We have, it goes on, and includes that we are required to have special shoreland ordinances for all shoreland in the state. So while this bill might only start by looking at this one place, it's a pretty simple step from there to say, well, then now we should have the same DNR test for any variance, anytime it affects a shoreland area. And that is what our big concern is once you start making exceptions where now the state has the final say in these land use decisions, it's very, very difficult to then say, well, we shouldn't use the same test in every other case. And then we end up with the complete erosion of that authority at the local level.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Sieben.
I would just remind committee members what was stated earlier, that the DNR used to have this certification or veto authority on variances from 1972, from the time that the riverway was designated, until this Supreme Court decision. So what this legislation is doing is reestablishing that DNR authority.
Is there further discussion from members of the committee? Questions? If not, is there anybody else in the audience who needed to speak to the bill? Come forward quickly, sir, and please identify yourself and go ahead.
My name is Brian Zeller. I'm former mayor of Lakeland, Minnesota. was the mayor at the time of the Hubbard decision. I'm current chair of the Middle St. Croix Water Management Organization, here speaking on behalf of myself and the interests of former constituents. Would like to point out that the Wild Scenic Act is actually the Wild Scenic and Recreational Act. That's often missed. If you look at our section of the river, it's heavily recreational. It's not this, it's not what the image conjures when you hear wild and scenic. So we need to balance that. You know, property owners deal with multiple high impact uses on the river as well as the scenic value and beauty of it. I agree with council member from Afton. We need to find balance. I think we could do a better job of that. But in order for that to happen, there has to be a discussion. This does not provide balance. You effectively put all of the decision-making in the hands of one state employee, the area hydrologist. That is not balanced. I just can't stress enough. You need the local unit of government. You need elected officials that are held accountable to be part of that process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Questions from the committee? Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2272 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
On that motion to Senate State and Local Government, is there a further discussion? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment that I agree with Mr. Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Having served 16 years in local government, I think we find it very often that there are state agencies which come in and try to overturn our decisions or prevent them from being happening, and that I think really do circumvent local control. And quite frankly, we try to handle these matters in a timely fashion, and I don't think that timely is necessarily a way that many of our agencies can be described in providing responses. And therefore, I certainly intend to vote against this motion.
Thank you. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out again that DNR told me that over the 30-year time span up to the Hubbard decision in 2010, there were less than 10 requests for contested case hearings. So I don't think that this is a huge expansion of the DNR's authority as has been expressed.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. I used to, part of my district touched up against a Mississippi River Corridor management area, and so I get a little concerned about, you know, if we start this here, we'll move it to the next section of river, and so I hope thoughtfully part of the discussion becomes as we move to state and local gov, how we limit this, or you know, what this looks like relative to all the other areas that the DNR has interest in and would have control over variances. And so I'm not going to oppose the bill, but I just want to be careful that this isn't going to rapidly expand to interfere with other management areas.
Senator Sieben, further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Sieben renews her motion that Senate File 2272 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion, chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hand. Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
And then we have, I think, everybody but Senator Dibble, who came here.
I'm supposed to text him when he's sitting at the table.
I know he's presenting a bill. Is everybody else here? Is Senator Osmick outside? Oh, he's right here. Never mind. everybody else here? Senator Eaton, you wish to remove your motion that we reconsider the vote on Senate File 2256. Is that your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is there further discussion of that? I'm sure if the roll call hasn't been requested, it should be, because I do want to make sure everybody is present for this one, since we were pretty close to all present there, but not all.
Roll call.
So on that, can we see if Senator Dibble can come back now? Why don't you start calling the roll, and we'll give him a minute. He's here.
He's okay there.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify, what is the next stop?
The next stop is Committee on State and Local Government, and then it would have to go to Finance as well.
And so it will pass through the Finance?
It has to go to Finance, I believe. Yes. There is a fiscal note with it, too. So on that, now let me clarify. This vote is to reconsider. Then we have to vote on the bill. This is just to bring it up, to put it before us.
Mr. Chair, this is a vote to reconsider. That would put the bill back in front of you.
Okay. Do you wish a roll call on that as well?
Yes.
Okay. On the motion to bring the bill back in front of us from Senator Eaton, please take the roll.
Marty.
Yes.
Senator Scalzi.
Yes.
Senator Eaton.
Yes.
Senator Sieben.
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Rosen.
No.
Senator Brown.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Coonan.
No.
Senator Herr.
Yes.
Senator Benson.
No.
Senator Schmidt.
Unexpected. Yes.
Senator Weber.
No.
Senator Osmek.
No.
By a vote of 8-6, the bill is now in front of us again. And Senator Herr, you wish to renew your motion that Senate file 256, which was not amended, be recommended passed, referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, and there's a request for roll call on that again. Is there further discussion? If not, please take the roll.
Senator Marty.
Aye.
Senator Scalzi.
Yes.
Senator Eaton.
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Sieben.
Yes.
Senator Rosen.
No.
Senator Brown.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Coonan.
No.
Senator Herr.
Yes.
Senator Benson.
No.
Senator Schmidt.
Yes.
Senator Weber.
No.
Senator Osmek.
No.
By a vote to 8-6, that motion does prevail, and the bill is now on its way to state and local government. Thank you for those of you who came in for that.
Thank you.
We will continue the agenda with Senate file. Is Senator Wieger in the room now? We need Senator Wieger now. I saw he was here earlier. Neither of these are agency bills, so we sort of need Senator Wieger here. Senator Sieben?
Does he have any co-authors on the bill?
Yes, we could look at that while we're waiting for him to come
Senator
forward.
Senator Scalzi?
Senator Scalzi is the author, co-author of Senate File 2016. Senator Scalzi, are you able to begin presenting that bill until Senator Wieger can arrive?
I could make a try at it, but I'm not the author, put it that way, but I would be the vehicle to allow the testifiers to have a chance.
Yes, so maybe we'll bring up the bill, Senate File 2016, then. And we have three witnesses who had wished to speak to it. I'm not sure who's in favor, opposed, or where they are, but I see Mr. Meyer at the table and a different Mr. Meyer, apparently from DNR, is listed as well, and Julie Ekman, and also Craig Johnson. So please go ahead. I'm not sure, ma'am, if you want to begin, or who, or Senator Scalzi, did you have any comments on this?
All I would say, thank you, Mr. Chair. All I would have to say in the absence of Senator Wieger is that this would give the DNR a little bit more authority related to water use permitting. And as many of you know, Senator Wieger is a senator in the White Bear Lake area, and there's been a lot of work done this year on water permitting and water usage, and so we would like to have the testimony for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, Senator Wieger's arriving, but Mr. Meyer, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, briefly, this bill Senator Wieger drafted that follows the recommendations from a report that the legislature asked us to prepare last session, dealing with additional tools needed for groundwater management, groundwater appropriation activities. I believe you do have a copy of the report in your packet, and Ms. Ekman from our Division of Ecological Water Resources can go through the bill. We also do have an author's amendment that I believe addresses most of the concerns that some of the folks may be presenting before you. And the one thing I'm not sure is in the amendment or not would change the effective date for the report in the last section of the bill from 2015 to 2016.
And we will make sure that's incorporated in the amendment, but it's being distributed now. So maybe now that Senator Wieger is with us, you can go ahead with your brief introductory comments, and then we'll have testimony from Ms. Ekman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I apologize. You know we have a hearing going on at policy. You are totally committed to groundwater sustainability. You've asked what are the tools that are needed. And to accomplish that, the DNR has responded with the report. You will hear most of those recommendations in Senate File 2016. The amendment, the A1, is an attempt to reach out to concerned stakeholders to improve the bill. And so the provisions that you'll see there have been discussed with, I believe, League of Cities, some of the producers, and others. And I want you to know I am strongly committed to working with others on its journey so that we can get the bottom line of getting some additional tools to reach our common objective. You might ask, why am I here? It's because in part of my district, White Bear Lake, we have a crisis. The 6 feet, the level has gone down in White Bear Lake, and there's been a great deal of discussion, a robust community conversation as to the prudent management of water resources. The Chamber of Commerce, Conservation District, we are now in the process of having the first ever groundwater management plan proposed by the DNR for Ramsey, Washington, part of Anoka County. Two more to follow in the state. So it's directly affected my district, and while I feel an obligation to be involved further on these policies. And members, I did discuss this with Chair Marty. I didn't want to be presumptuous in going before you as experts on this topic to suggest this is what we do. But with that understanding, with the huge concern it is in my district, I bring this forward because it clearly is a state issue. So if someone would like to
Senator
offer the
Scalzi
A1.
We'll move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape he wants, and incorporated in that would be on page 9, line 25 of the bill to strike 2015 and insert 2016.
Enforcement.
On that motion, the A1 plus that additional change, is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Ekman, welcome to the committee, and I'll point out, as Mr. Meyer or Senator Wieger did, the copy of the report is in our packets.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and members of the committee. For the record, I am Julie Ekman. I'm a section manager at the DNR in the Ecological and Water Resources Division. And we mentioned the report. The purpose of that report to the legislature was for DNR to review its statutory authority and responsibilities and to recommend additional law changes that would further refine and strengthen Minnesota's groundwater management policies. And then those recommendations are in this bill. Starting with Section 1 of the bill, this is really just a technical change to clarify that DNR will have the authority to investigate those who hold permits as well as those that do not hold permits. That was just a minor technical change. And then in Section 2, this addresses once-through systems. These are also known as pump and dump. It's taking groundwater and running it through a heating and cooling system and then discharging it to the ground or to surface waters. And we believe this is not a wise use of groundwater. There are more and more homeowners that are installing these systems, and it's not real clear to them the amount of water they're using, so they may not even be aware that they need permits from the DNR. And the water use fee for these systems is quite steep compared to other water uses. So where the recommendation is that DNR not be able to issue permits for those smaller, under 5 million gallons a year uses. Moving on to Section 3. This addresses water use permitting fees and penalties for not paying. We believe that a steeper penalty would be an incentive for people to pay their fees on time. The fees are due February 15th of every year, along with a report of water use. And when we don't get things in a timely manner, that causes DNR extra time and staff time in tracking people down and communicating with them. So a steeper penalty would motivate that. And then also, cities have approached us with interest in having us take another look at stormwater use and how there are innovative ways of changing their systems to use stormwater instead of groundwater, and we believe this would be a benefit to all. So they are suggesting that the fee for stormwater use be waived, and this section would give the DNR the authority to waive that fee. To Section 4 here. This is about water use records and DNR's authority to inspect those records. A permitted water user, that's those users that use 10,000 gallons a day or more than 1 million gallons a year. They are required to record their monthly water use and then report to us on an annual basis every February 15th. And given that large volumes of water are used and there's growing concern about overuse, inaccurate information can pose a significant challenge to us for sustainable water management. So this would enable DNR to inspect people's records.
Section 5 was deleted.
Section 5 has been deleted, yes, thank you.
Section
6. This is addressing non-compliant reporting. We want to remove the financial incentive to underreport water use. The water use fees are based on how much water someone uses, so there's an incentive there to kind of report poor water use. Finding that 5 to 10% of permit holders are reporting late by 2 months or more. And again, this incurs additional cost to the state to follow up with people to get them to report. And late reporting also slows down data analysis. The water use data is widely used not just by DNR, but by other agencies and consultants. So we do publish that information on our website, so it is important that that data get to us in a timely manner. And currently the penalty for late reporting is 2%, and the vast majority of water users that have permits use less than 50 million gallons of water a year, so this 2% would add $2.80 a month to their bill, which is not an incentive. So we're looking for an incentive to encourage timely reporting.
Mr. Chairman, just on that section.
Yes.
The amendment does deal with that. We heard a concern from municipalities and domestic water suppliers about the provisions in Section B or Subdivision B, which put them in a different process to deal with that impact. We obviously cannot shut off a domestic water supplier to all the our households, right? So there's a whole different process in place. So we did address that concern with the author's amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Second.
Then the next section, Section 7. This is giving DNR administrative penalty authority. That we need this authority in order to achieve better compliance with water appropriation laws and to help us meet our statutory responsibility to ensure sustainable groundwater use. We're finding that illegal water use is a growing concern in the state, and tracking down illegal operators creates a heavy workload for permitting staff and for our enforcement staff. Currently, these kinds of violations are misdemeanors, and they're prosecuted by the county attorney. The fee schedule, or the penalty schedule, ranges from $50 to $750 for such an offense. And some of our more egregious and repeat violators are just paying these fines as a cost of doing business, and they're not changing, they're not stopping their violation. This authority would enable DNR to follow a civil process to force compliance with state water use laws, and also would enable us, in those rare cases where it's needed, to levy steep penalties against the worst violators and the repeat violators. This would also bring relief to DNR for the costs that we incur for compliance research and enforcement work. Some of the major program elements that DNR has been implementing over the years is we have increased our efforts to address water use violations. We've also increased our efforts to identify non-compliant water users. And we've also begun 3 groundwater management areas where we have local concerns about water issues. The groundwater management area process gives us focused resources on those areas. We've also recently implemented our new online permitting and reporting system, MPARS, and that improves water use reporting accuracy and simplifies fee payment. But even with all of this, it doesn't directly address the violators of water law, and APO authority would fill this void and help us bring all permitted water users into compliance with state laws. And moving on to Section 8. Currently, the fees for after-the-fact permit applications are simply a doubling of the normal application fee. But again, identifying these and verifying noncompliance requires considerable time and then increases the expenses to the state. We did a research for compliance last year, and we looked for irrigation systems that were operating without a permit. We found that 2 to 20% of these systems did not have the appropriate permits. So these additional fees would help us bring people into compliance. And then finally, Section 9, the report that on water reuse. We're hearing again from communities that they want us to take another look at water reuse, and we also believe that this is a necessary tool to get at water sustainability. There are current laws on the books that don't allow certain practices, like injecting water back into an aquifer. So we believe that the state needs to be able to respond to that and look to that going to the future. We know that other states are engaged in that practice, and maybe it can work here too. So our recommendation was that the Environmental Quality Board pull various entities together and write a report on this issue. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Senator Brown and then Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on the amendment on 1.4. It changes the wording to permit holder. And while Mr. Meyer did a good job of explaining who wouldn't be in that category, could you give me examples of who would be in that? It sounds like farmers, homeowners, industry. I'm just trying to get a broad idea of who would fall into that category.
Permit holders are those that pump more than 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year. So it typically would not be your average homeowner with their own private well.
And Mr. Chair, would that
thank you.
Would that include what percentage of farmers would that include?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, any farmer that is irrigating would need a permit from us, And it would also include feedlots.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I first apologize if I'm not, this question isn't very focused, but this is what I'm trying to get at. So I'm looking at your bill, Senator Wieger, and understand that some of these updates need to be made, and they seem very reasonable. What I'm asking, and maybe it's best addressed to the DNR, is how this legislation will help. If you could clarify for me how it will help some of the problems that we're facing with our groundwater. So, for instance, in South Washington County, Cottage Grove and Woodbury are really in a tough spot because the I believe it's the Prairie du Chien or the Jordan aquifers are both their levels are decreasing at so quickly that it's impeding development. The cities are afraid that it's impeding future development of new home construction, which is obviously important to both of the cities. So what in here is going to help that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I'll just say initially a significant part in providing tools is to get a better remedy in place so that there's a consequence of not being compliant. Right now, there is no disincentive for being noncompliant. Reference was made to a very small penalty of $2.80 a month or so. So you can just let it go by. The majority of users are compliant and responsible, but for those bad actors, they're contributing to the problem. So by putting a consequence for action, better monitoring capability, the APO with the penalties in place, you know, very much directed for those egregious actors, that will contribute to us on the goal of groundwater sustainability.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
And to follow up on that, why not raise the fee for the especially large users of water? For example, I know that you know where I'm going with this, Mr. Meyer. 3M is permitted to pump millions of gallons of water to treat the PFC pollution in South Washington County, which some think, and I think logic points to, that that's having an impact on the aquifers. Why not charge more for the permits so that it can more adequately reflect the usage on the aquifer and provide some sort of, it wouldn't provide relief directly to the cities, but at least then more accurately reflect the impact it's having on the surrounding communities.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, that's a great point, one that we tried very hard to implement last year. It was actually in the governor's supplemental budget contained language that would have raised the water appropriation fees. Unfortunately, we couldn't get any traction in the Senate. The House did pass that provision. Right now, if you look at the price you pay for water, it's 0.0001 cents per gallon. Our water is very cheap, and it's our rarest resource, or soon will be. So we're going to need to continue that conversation because ultimately putting your money where your mouth is what needs to happen. But given the no-fees sentiment that we were faced with last session, we weren't able to move that ball forward in this body, unfortunately.
Even there is one small change in the section 2 where they are eliminating the once through permits.
Once through, right.
Which that's happening with residential people using once through systems now? Ms. Heckman?
Mr. Chair, yes. It is an option for residential users. It's a geothermal heating and cooling.
Once through where they're just...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Further questions for these witnesses. I think we also had, I don't know if this Phil Meyer at DNR is here.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have Rodman Smith from enforcement if there's a need and some others
as
needed.
And I know Mr. Johnson from the cities wants to speak to the bill as well. So. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to be back. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. My comments on this actually can be fairly brief. The author's amendment that you adopted actually significantly was crafted to address concerns that I've been working on with the author and with the department. And I think it's very helpful. There's, just so the committee is aware, there's one thing that deals with fees, so it, we'll have an opportunity to deal with that when we get to with the budget sections of the hearing process. But in Section 3, starting, it's the new language starting on my copy on 4.19, I believe. And Mr. Chair and members, that language is intended to help cities and goes partly to Senator Sieben's last question about where is there some assistance for cities in this. This is intended to help with projects where stormwater would be, instead of just diverted into a lake or river, used for another purpose. The easier we make that, and there's a question of why are we charging another appropriation fee when what we're actually doing is taking stormwater and using it for a different purpose. It actually is coming out of a public water conveyance system and being used for a different purpose before it goes away. So one is there was the idea of forgiving the additional fee on that, and then two, the idea of making it easier and encouraging those kinds of projects by making it a little cheaper to do them. Every time you use a different source of water other than groundwater, you're reducing the strain on the groundwater supply. So that's one thing. I think the other significant one is the EQB study at the end of the bill that we are actually very strong proponents of, because there are numerous state laws and codes, building codes, plumbing codes, health codes, all kinds of interrelated things that make it difficult, if not impossible, to have either stormwater be used or wastewater be reused for other purposes rather than just discharging it. And so we really need to analyze where are those problems, what are other states doing successfully that we could be doing here. There's a lot of states with severe water shortage issues that really have worked out a lot of how these reuse issues can be addressed, and we just haven't faced that. So we haven't got our laws in the same shape that they do in some cases. So I think those are the two things that we're continuing to work on and that I think do help address some of the water use concerns that cities have.
Thank you.
Other than that, Mr. Chair, we'll be continuing to work with the department on this, and we think the bill is moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you. Further discussion. Is there anybody else in the audience who needed to speak to this bill? Is there further discussion? If not, Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 2016 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on
Judiciary.
Any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Senator Wieger, you got another one, Senate File 683.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. House File, I believe, 683.
House File, excuse me, you're correct.
683 establishes a Legislative Water Commission, and I will, in terms of the need, comprehensive policy, various entities are reviewing water right now. This would provide some overall direction with recommendations, and I have two witnesses to identify the need for it and assist in responding to questions. First, go to whichever you'd like.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just making sure I get as much of your time as I can today. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. This piece of legislation we worked on very closely with the House author last year. We're glad to see it up in the Senate this year. The Legislative Water Commission actually existed long ago in Minnesota, and the two people you're going to hear speak today both were around for that. The need for this really has come about, as I'm sure this committee is very well aware, the number and variety of issues coming up related to water and the complexity of those issues, as well as how different agency programs have to interrelate for those issues to be successfully addressed, has just been continuing to escalate, take more and more of the time of the legislature and of interested groups, and really has gotten to a point where having a 20-minute discussion in a committee hearing is not adequate to the complexity in some of the issues. The Legislative Water Commission was a group bicameral bipartisan that previously existed where complicated water issues were discussed during the interim. The group would have plenty of time to bring in experts from all varieties of opinion rather than just have one or two who could be there for the hearing that day. And you could actually chew on the issues, bring agency staff in to work on the issues, bring them back to work on them again. And it was a way where we ended up with a core of people in both the House and the Senate who really had expertise in water law and what was going on in water programs and state agencies. With the amount of time, money, and effort that is now going into water, especially with the infusion of the new resources from the sales tax amendment, we really felt that we need to restore that level of discussion and interest in water policy to make sure we're coordinating things and not having people running in different directions. So the League has actually for several years been supporting the reinstatement of the Legislative Water Commission to rebuild that legislative discussion and that place where water policy can really be thoroughly vetted before it shows up in an amendment late night in a committee or on the floor or someplace, and nobody has heard about it before. So we're very excited to see it, and we support the bill.
Thank you, Senator Price.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Len Price, and I'm here today not as the Executive Director of Conservation Corps of Minnesota. We don't take positions on bills as a nonprofit, but I am here as a former member of the First Water Commission. It was my privilege to be part of the 1989 groundwater omnibus bill negotiations. And in that bill, we created a water commission as well as doing a whole host of other things related to trying to manage the various issues that we have for water for Minnesota. And kind of the guide point for me is, if you look at the geography of Minnesota, we're at the pinnacle of three major watersheds in North America. Our water goes to Hudson's Bay, up the Red River. It goes into the Atlantic Ocean through the Great Lakes, and it goes to the Gulf of Mexico down the Mississippi River. So we have to be good stewards of our water, and that's just a picture of the surface water. In the 89 groundwater bill, we tried to also talk about the groundwater and how it's related to all the surface water that we have in our state. So it gave the, as Mr. Johnson expressed, it gave policymakers, legislators from both parties, both parts of the legislative process, time to sit and deliberate and understand and become well-versed in the issues that policymakers need to have an understanding of. You know, each agency, like the DNR before in the previous bill, has its silo of responsibility. It has its parameters outlined in rules and statute. But the ultimate policy is in your hands, legislators. They're the ones who create those guidelines to help everybody understand what might be the best way to answer some of these questions. And, of course, nothing stays the same. In these discussions today, you didn't talk about water sealing, well sealing. You didn't talk about septic system regulations. You didn't talk about standards for well inspections or any of the other numerous things that are part of water policy. And as Mr. Johnson so vividly illustrated, you get maybe 20 minutes to talk about this. You're going to exert your expertise and background and make a good, solid decision. What the Water Commission will allow is more time, more thought, more input. I think Senator Rosen had a nice phrase today. She said, you need to have all the stakeholders at the table. And that's what the commissions in state government do. Can you imagine trying to create in this committee the Lessard-Sams package for appropriation? Can you imagine doing all the 71 projects for LCCMR's package of appropriations? It's nuts. You'd kill yourself. And so the commission concept works well, and I, as a private citizen, as a former legislator, encourage you to support this commission and create this again. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Price. Were you in the House when in 89 when that passed, and then you served on it when you were in the Senate?
I did, in both.
Questions from the committee. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of information, Senator Wieger. I haven't heard anything, but I'm just curious, have you reached out to the agricultural interests and groups as far as this issue is concerned, and have you had a response from them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I'm available to meet with other stakeholders. I mentioned that on the previous bill. I have not formally reached out, but would be available on call.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Benson, did you have your hand up?
No, but Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to comment. We're adding another layer of review, and it's my understanding that the chairs of the relevant committees already have the authority to call a joint committee hearing on a special topic if they determine that an issue needs to be delved into, if it's something that is of statewide or regional significance. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons that the existing committee chairs, who I assume would be participating in this, can call a hearing. And we have lots and lots of subcommittees and working groups specializing in various topic areas. I'm not sure why we're creating another commission. We just had more water authority given the Met Council has a new water management district. I believe it covers part of your areas. It does cover part of the district I serve.
Ms. Chair, that's the DNR's proposed groundwater management?
DNR, but the Met Council also has some new authority.
Yes, they're okay.
And so we just keep adding layers and layers, and we don't ever actually, we don't reduce anything. We don't streamline anything. We just add fees and fines, and we add another legislative working group. I guess I'm not really seeing a compelling problem that needs to be solved here that couldn't be solved by chairs of the relevant committees saying, all right, we're going to get together and we're going to have a meeting on this topic.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I think I can help on that issue just a little bit in that I do think that this would actually help in that regard, where instead of having things show up one after another and we're wondering now what's Met Council up to, what's DNR up to, what does this mean about the stormwater permits for all the cities in that area, that this group would have the time to actually dig into all of that. And it would not just be a one-time thing based on the groundwater management area and the White Bear Lake area. This would be something they could do on a statewide basis, you know, every year. What we found in the past, and I worked with this group extensively till it was abolished along with most of the legislative commissions in 1994, I believe, was that it was really a good way to have all of those issues kind of pre-vetted so that when the committee got together to meet, there were, at that time, five, I believe, members in each body that were on it, and they were all on the committee, and they knew what the discussion was. They knew how the programs worked, and the committee's discussion could kind of be based with those people playing a real active role in leading that discussion on the policy. So rather than doing it as like a special hearing on pollinators or, you know, some of the things that we've done over the last couple of years, this is an ongoing review of kind of all the water stuff going on in the state where the legislature gets much more involved in the policy oversight during the interim so that when they come back for the next session, they've identified five or six things where they think the state needs to do it differently. But one big difference from the previous iteration of this, Mr. Chair, that I would point out is the membership is equal partisanly on this commission. It's actually three from each party regardless of what the majorities or minorities are, which is, I think, a very interesting and probably useful change.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, when we set up the Sunset Commission, that was equally balanced, nothing actually moved. So I will withhold opinion as to whether that's a good idea or not. I just have a concern that we already have, the legislature already has the power to do this. If this is some effort to put in sort of a personal training regimen so they actually do it on a regular basis, I'm not sure that we're actually solving a fundamental problem. And I'm sorry, I respect that it takes a lot of work to come up with the right structure for this. I don't think we're doing anything that can't already be done.
Senator Price.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I think you are on the right track. It isn't enough time to just have one or two meetings. The commission's function before was to consistently meet, to become really well-versed in all the issues and have all the stakeholders be there, so that you actually produced a product that was ready to go legislatively. It was a way to vet not an inch deep, but several inches deep into the issues that are related to water. And these are not simple things. There are so many interrelationships that it takes a while to get your head wrapped around the nuances in statute and in rules and also what direction you need to go to solve some of these problems. So I served on commissions more than one in my time here. I'd have to say that in terms of output, in terms of changing policy and addressing the issues, the Water Commission had a much better record than even, say, LCCMR or the Energy Commission that I served on, because the mission was to bring all these things together and try to create a policy that would work and to get into the weeds on the issue, not just a cursory one or two meeting kind of a thing. That's not to diminish the efforts that agencies do today or anybody else. It's so complicated, you need more time on task.
Senator Benson, one quick comment on that. I was around in the year when we did abolish all those commissions, and I think it was reasonable to abolish a lot of commissions. We ought to look through these things from time to time. I think I'd say that of the issues we deal with here, I would not want to be on this water one. I know there are other members of the committee who would. I think, like, the energy issues and this are so big and they are looming as much more significant problems. Yes, we could have more hearings and so on, but I think having a group of folks who maybe not just from, like, this committee or the Ag Committee, which would have a lot of interest in this commission, too, I think it is one area where they actually, a number of people, spend more time getting into the broader issue. So I hear what you're saying. The Met Council does this, and we're having, well, we got watershed districts, we got all these other things. I really think this is not meant to govern. This is meant to help look through where the policy is and where it should be headed. So I understand your concern. I actually happen to think this is probably a good one. And one of the other problems with too many commissions is you can't find enough legislators who want to serve on them, too. So there is, I think that was one of the reasons for getting rid of a lot of them. But this one is bringing back one that was there and I think did a lot of great work way back when. And I vaguely remember it, though I never served on it, Senator Price. Is there further discussion on this bill? Is there anybody else who needed to speak to it? Not Senator Scalzi. Moves. Senate file, House file 683. Mr. Knopf mentioned that the appropriation, this would not start going until 2015, and he suggested on line 20 of page 2, we delete everything from after 180,000 through 167,000, so it would read 180,000 is appropriated from the general fund in fiscal year 2015 to the LCC for purposes of this act. I assume that's what the desire would be if you're not starting until next fiscal year. Is that okay?
Yeah.
If so, Senator Scalzi would. Senator Scalzi moves deleting everything between 180,000 and the second is on line 20 of page 2. Any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. This bill does go to finance. Anywhere else?
Yes.
Perhaps state government?
State and local government.
But
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, this is a bill that points legislators to a commission. So by Senate rule, it has to go through state and local government and through the Rules Committee before it's considered. So it would eventually go to finance. And I'm not sure if it would go to finance before rules or after, but I'm thinking it would go to finance after rules. The Senate rule does say that it has to go to state and local government and to the Rules Committee prior to being reported to the floor for final consideration.
Senator Wiegel, your bill's got some more stops. So Senator Scalzi moves House File 683 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
With that, no further business. This meeting is adjourned.